Good afternoon. On the way back from Middlebury, Vermont, where we went to pick up the story of the petrified Indian boy, we stopped in Rutland to pay a brief call on my friends the Kultonskis. Alfred is Rutland's capable fire chief, and his sister Helen manages Riverside, the woman's reformatory up there in Rutland. It was hot when we arrived, and Helen asked if we wouldn't like something cooling to drink. And thinking that she might have some raspberry shrub or old-fashioned Vermont switchel, we accepted. But the tall, frosty pitcher that Helen brought out contained a totally different drink than I've ever tasted. She calls it Rhubarb Royal. And it's been a long time since anything as tangy, tart, and tasty has tickled my palate. And it was smooth and refreshing, too. But when I asked for the recipe, Helen shook her head. "I don't know, Blackie," she said, "just how you would make it in small quantities. You see, I had 500 pounds of fresh rhubarb given to me. And after making up a dozen pies and a tub of sauce and putting up goodness knows how many jars, I had all that stewed rhubarb left. So I mixed up this concoction." "Well," I said, sipping my third glass, "what's in it besides rhubarb? Anything?" "Oh, yes," she said. "I had some maple syrup and sugar left over and some honey. And I put in a dozen oranges and three or four lemons, and this is the result. It's diluted, of course, with cold water. Have some more." Now, I'm wondering if any of you folks know anything about making this rhubarb royal. And I'm also wondering if anybody ever makes spruce or birch beer these days. And how many modern farmers, I wonder, carry a jug of switchel with them when they start to mow the lower field on a hot, sultry July morning? Now, there's a drink that'll keep a fellow from sweating while swinging a scythe. And it used to be specially appreciated by the boys in the top hayloft up in the barn, stowing away under those hot shingles. How do you make switchel? Why, we used to fill up a stone jug about two-thirds full of spring water and then add some ginger and a little vinegar and a half a dozen dollops of blackstrap molasses. Some folks used to put in a little rum just to flavor it. But that defeats the purpose for which switchel is intended. I'm told the combination of ginger and molasses keeps you cool in dog days weather, while rum, so they say, will make you sweat. And that reminds me of the almost fatal consequences which befell old Joel Dunn the day he cut the Widow Riley's marsh grass on the Saugus Lynn line near where the General Electric plant stands today. This Joel Dunn was a pathetic sort of a chap, well-meaning but rather simple-minded. He was first seen limping toward Lynn on a wild, windy November night. So weary and chilled, he frequently had to step into the bushes or crouch behind a stone wall to get out of the biting wind, which cut straight through his thin and tattered clothing. His shoes had great holes through which the miry ooze of the marsh road squashed and splashed. His leather small clothes and leggings were besmirched with mud, and his wide-brimmed, rusty brown hat, flabby and flapping, offered little protection against the driving sleet. Around his waist in a well-worn fox-skin belt, Joel kept his few possessions. A rusty sheath knife, a coin or two, his pipe, and some soggy acorns tied up in rags. When the going got too tough, Joel would stand in the shelter of a big tree and with one bony hand wipe whiskers out of his eyes. His beard was black and stringy, and his hair came down to his shoulders. It was dark when Joel reached the foot of the hill on which stood his objective, the famous Blue Anchor Tavern. And as he toiled up the muddy slope, he made out the rain-slashed sign with its faded blue anchor and the post where in summer a tame bear was chained for the amusement of the tavern's guests. At the foot of the broad stone steps, he slipped and fell, his forlorn figure outlined by the mellow yellow light from the taproom windows, slanting through the sleet. Now, Captain Thomas Marshall, the proprietor of the Blue Anchor Tavern, was no man to turn away any weary traveler. And hearing of Joel's plight, he ordered him brought before the great fireplace. And there he plied him with generous slugs of brandy, catching from Joel's few remarks that he'd walked through the storm all the way from Plymouth, a distance in those days of more than 100 miles, and he'd had nothing to eat. Well, a bowl of hot turkey soup and some bread and cheese and a nightcap of hot buttered rum fixed Joel up pretty good. And he was indeed thankful when Captain Marshall gave him blankets and showed him where to bed down above the horse stalls in the huge stable. The next morning, Mr. Dunn was up at dawn, and after having some flapjacks and donuts and coffee, he said to his host, "You are a true Samaritan. You brought me a poor tramp out of the storm and gave me food and shelter. Now, sir, what can I do to repay your kindness? Somewhat surprised at this burst of oratory, Captain Marshall said, well, if you'd like to cut a little firewood. That was enough for Joel. He peeled off his coat, grabbed the axe, and soon the air was filled with flying chips and snatches of sea songs that made even the tavern keeper blush. And that afternoon, Captain Marshall said, Joel, these big fireplaces eat up a lot of wood. How would you like to stay on here for a spell and take over the woodpile? I'll give you room and board and 25 cents a day. So Joel stayed, and his woodpile became the wonder of all who tarried at the Blue Anchor Tavern. On bright, crisp winter mornings, he'd set forth at sunup with his axe, saw, and sled for the Great Lynn Woods. And there among the thick snow-laden trees, he'd chop and saw and split and sing all day, stopping only long enough to toss a few crumbs to the chattering blue jays when he ate his lunch or to take a pot shot at a rabbit or a partridge. The following spring, Joel started another woodpile on the south side of the tavern, a beautiful woodpile, 8-foot silvery birch logs. And out in front, where it could dry in the sun, he piled up all the driftwood he'd brought in his cart from Lynn Beach, driftwood which would snap and crackle and burn with blue and green flames. This man-made mountain of firewood was a sight to warm the heart of any cold and weary traveler. And the women folks in the neighborhood were always taunting their lazy husbands with, why don't you saw and split the way Joel Dunn does? This wood box of mine is always empty. Now the exception was the wood box behind the kitchen stove of the widow, Riley, who lived comfortably but alone just back of the tavern on a narrow winding lane. Mrs. Riley was known far and wide for her ready Irish wit, her heart which was as big as all outdoors, and she was always taking in strays, cats, dogs, and other animals. Why, she even took in Joel, patched up his clothes, cut his hair, trimmed his whiskers into a neat Van Dyke beard, and quite often she invited him to come in for supper, preferring his simple, courteous company to the more sporty companionship of the dandies that hung around the tavern. In return for these favors, Joel shoveled snow, plowed and planted her garden, chased after the widow's cow when she strayed into the woods, and, of course, he kept her well supplied with firewood. Well, it was a hot July morning when Joel was passing the widow's cottage, and she called to ask if he'd be interested in cutting the salt hay on her shore property. Joel grinned sheepishly and loud as, how there want nothing he'd rather do on a nice summer day than swing a scythe and stack grass on the marshes. So Mrs. Riley put him up a lunch. Cold-boiled eggs, chicken sandwiches, cucumber pickles, and she made up a jug of refreshing switchel. You drink lots of it, Joel, she said. It will keep you from perspiring. Well, at the tavern, Joel set the lunch basket and the jug on the steps and went to fetch his cart and tools. And while he was gone, a couple of jokesters grabbed the lunch and loaded it. They rolled the boiled eggs in salt. They shoved red peppers into the sandwiches and plastered them with mustard. And into the jug of switchel, they poured one whole quart of Old Medford rum. As Joel started off, one of them warned, you want to look out you don't get sunstruck. It's going to be hotter than Tophet on that mash today. And the other lout added, yeah, I heard about a fella down to Nobreport what sweat so much he dissolved. Honest Injun. All they found of that fella was a puddle of salt water and the buttons off in his coat and pants. And with those cheery thoughts, Joel started for the shore, noting that the tide was way out and the sun getting hotter by the minute. He enjoyed cutting the rank, pungent marsh grass and stacking the bundle securely on the staddle, adding layer after layer. In 3 hours, he had as handsome and sturdy a haystack as his woodpile, and it was almost as high. When his tummy told him it was lunchtime, he climbed to the top of his grassy tower and opened the basket. The eggs looked good, so he plopped one in his mouth, a trick he often did in the tap room to amuse the children. But the salt nearly strangled him. Grabbing the jug, he tipped it back and let the contents trickle down his throat. It was the tastiest switchel he'd ever had. But then, wasn't the widow Riley always fixing things up nice for him? The sandwiches were good, sure, but just a bit too lively, with all that extra mustard and pieces of red pepper. So Joel took another long pull at the jug, and then another to quench the fire in his throat. And then, what with the hard work and the hot sun and eating and all, he felt a bit drowsy. So kicking off his boots, he leaned back on the haystack and was soon sound asleep. All that hot afternoon, while the July sun beat down upon him, Joel Dunn slept and sweat, while the tide turned and began creeping back. Little ribbons of blue among the green, then wider stretches of blue-green water that soon covered all the marsh. And still Joel slept and snored and sweat, and the gulls wheeled aloft in the deep blue sky overhead, and the fog piled up in the east, and then at last the sun went down behind the Saugus Hills, and the mist rolled in, a cold, chilling, wet fog. When Joel finally came to, it was pitch dark, and he felt terrible. First he was hot, and then cold. His limbs were stiff, his head throbbed, and his tongue, why, it tasted like a feather bed on fire. For a minute or two, he didn't know who he was or where. And when he reached down to feel of his badly sunburned feet, his fingers touched water. God blimey, I must be dissolving, he thought. And scared out of his wits, he raised a trembling finger to his parched lips and tasted. Salt, he screamed. I am dissolving. I've sweat myself to death. And as he tried to get up, his grassy bed, under the gentle caress of the high tide, began to collapse. And then he discovered he was marooned on a haystack with water all around him. The fishermen who came in answer to his scream said they could hear him hollering way out by Egg Rock. And he was in tough shape when they got him into the boat, shaking with chills and fever, and mumbling through teeth that chattered that never as long as he lived would any kind of liquor pass his lips again. Well, for several days, Joel Dunn lay at death's door. But old Dr. Jotham Tyndale pulled him back, and the widow Riley came and cared for him, and he slowly recovered. And a funny thing, instead of blaming the louts who had spiked his drink, Joel blamed the devil and the demon rum, and he became such an enthusiastic teetotaler, he wouldn't touch tea or coffee. Frequently, he'd stomp into the tap room and lecture on the evils of drink, to the embarrassment of Captain Marshall, a member in good standing of Boston's ancient and honorable artillery company. One day, Captain Marshall called Joel aside and told him, next Saturday, the ancients will pass through Saugus on their way from Boston to Salem, and I've invited them to stop here for light refreshments, and I don't want to hear any temperance lectures out of you. Those gentlemen can take care of themselves. Now, the generous host of the Blue Anchor Tavern had ordered for this occasion a huge hogshead of specially imported Barbados rum, just in on a ship over in Salem. And it was delivered at the tavern by a pair of oxen, hauling the barrel on a big pair of wheels. Joel could hardly eat his supper of red flannel hash, thinking about that hogshead of rum. Supposing, he said to himself, that some of those fine gentlemen take too much tomorrow and get the jim-jams as I did. Now, wouldn't that be a shame? Wiping his plate with a slab of bread, he thought, and what if those ancients have never tasted rum before? I'd better go do something about it. And dashing outdoors, he ran to where the hogshead loomed up against the star-lit sky as big as a barn. With the best intentions in the world, Joel seized a crowbar and pried out the chucks from under the massive wheels. The law of gravity did the rest. The wheels started downhill. Joel jumped, but not quick enough, and one leg was caught between the spokes of the rapidly turning wheel. Down, down he went, over and over, till at the bottom, the hogshead struck a tree and split wide open. When rescuers came with lanterns and dippers and mugs and straws to salvage the amber fluid, they found Joel Dunn drowned in a pool of rum. The well-meaning woodchopper had given his life in what he thought was a noble cause.